Okay, great, thanks. And thanks, of course, for the opportunity to be here. It's fun to see real winter. So what I'm going to talk about is fundamental interactions and inflation, and it's based on three papers. Sort of the motivation was in a more astrophysical paper that I did with Amber Miller, Marlene Loverde, and Licha Verde. And then the sort of more theoretical follow-up was a paper with Louis, who's here, and a paper that just came out. So this is, you know, the thing about this conference is we keep switching between vastly different topics. So let me just sort of reorient you about the big questions that Claudia talked about a couple days ago. And of course, these are only some of the big questions, because Claudia had a big job to describe for you all of the things we don't know about the universe, which is a lot. But one of the really important questions is, what is the fundamental physics of inflation? And did inflation even actually happen? This is sort of the, you know, the most accepted version of how we explain some of the puzzles we see in both the very large-scale features of our universe and where we think the structure that we see in terms of galaxies actually originated. But we don't actually have a very good idea of what the fundamental physics is. We have some ideas, some guesses, but we don't have a very good way to test that yet. And so part of this question is saying, well, we have lots of sort of models in the sense that there are small tweaks of this idea of spiral inflation, where we have a scalar field whose potential energy dominated the universe at some early time. But we're having trouble finding a very meaningful way to distinguish between those models. For the moment, most of them agree with sort of the basic couple of numbers that we get out from inflation. So we'd like to do better. And the real goal of all this, of course, is that inflation in the very early universe is a very high energy process. So the best of all worlds would be if there's some signature that's unique in some sense or that's surprising, suggested by very high energy physics or even string theory. So there are a couple of observational ways that we might be very hopeful about this, including a primordial gravitational wave, cosmic strings, this sort of thing. But non-Gaussianity, which is what I'll focus on, is, I think, one of the richest possibilities in this direction. So my plan is to tell you, remind you if you don't know, or explain briefly what non-Gaussianity is. And from a fundamental point of view, it's basically interactions of the inflaton. So I'll remind you how that works, and then talk about how, in a particular case, if we just take single field inflation, we can really beat this thing to death. And we can look at all of the properties of correlation functions in a single field model, and then we can have a good idea of what that means for all of the possible observations we could make as a test. OK, so first, what am I talking about when I'm talking about non-Gaussianity? So before we get to that point, let's just remind ourselves of this very basic scenario. So again, this is something that Claudia reviewed. But if we think there's some scalar field whose potential energy is responsible for sourcing inflation, the cool part about this is that the small quantum fluctuations of this field give us another very important feature, which is the large-scale structure. And so I'm going to call this field phi. Its fluctuations are delta phi. And those fluctuations are related to primordial curvature fluctuations. So the scalar fluctuations of the field and the scalar fluctuations of the metric sort of go together. And if we look at that after inflation, it's small perturbations in the curvature. So this is the two-point function for the curvature. It doesn't depend on scale. It just depends on the product of these two things. So in general, this is just some number, some amplitude. And that's what we measure. There can be a small deviation from that scale invariance, which basically has to do with the fact this isn't completely flat. So the flatness of this potential makes sure that inflation lasts long enough. But the fact that inflation comes to an end at some point, and one possibility is that it sort of rolls off this steep drop, gives us what we think a good rationale for the reason why we don't see exact scale invariance. But those are the two numbers that we can measure, and those are the two numbers that most models are able to match. So we need to go beyond that to distinguish between models. So how do we do that? Well, when I'm writing a fundamental model, I'm really writing some physics for the inflaton, right? I'm postulating some scalar field and calculating its correlations, its fluctuations. I can use physics that we know very well, GR, fluid dynamics, to translate these fluctuations into curvature and to run them forward in time into density fluctuations that evolve into the structure. So at any point that I can observe anything related to these quantities, in principle, I can track back and ask, what does that mean about the fundamental physics up here? And the simplest way to do that, here's again the picture that Claudia showed from WMAP. So we can look at anything all the way back to this last scattering surface where we see the CMB fluctuations. So those are these. This is the temperature fluctuations of the cosmic microwave background. So you're seeing hot and cold spots on a very small scale. And you can start to do statistics on this. So this is WMAP5. The data has gotten, you know, amazingly better since COBE first picked up this signal. So you can start to ask, what can we measure? And the simplest thing to measure is just the two-point function. What's the amplitude of these fluctuations? So everything is normalized as a temperature variation, so that's delta T. And then we're going to look at the amplitude. So let me remind you that we would be done if these were Gaussian fluctuations, right? In terms of statistics for a distribution calculated like this, we said we were looking at temperature variations, so the mean is zero. And if you measure for me the amplitude of fluctuations, that's the variance, and you're done. Those would be the only two numbers you know. Of course, for generic distribution, you can go further, right? You can ask, what are the higher order connected moments? So here's one. And these are often normalized in a particular way and given names, especially the first two. So one is a skewness, which tells you which way the distribution leans, and one is a kurtosis, which tells you kind of how fat the distribution is. And again, for a Gaussian, anything above the mean and the variance are set to zero because these are the connected moments. So visually, what is that? Well, here's the black is a Gaussian curve. The red and the green are non-Gaussian curves. And I've shown you curves that are skewed in both directions. So for example, if you look at the red non-Gaussian curve, you can see that two things have happened. One is this peak has shifted. And the other thing is that this tail for many sigma fluctuations is suppressed. Okay? So if you want to look at the probability for a 3-sigma fluctuation, it's much smaller here than it is for the green. And those are positively and negatively skewed distributions, depending on which tau is suppressed. So again, if I can measure that any aspect of that distribution in any of these variables, then I'm measuring non-Gaussianity. So the two things I showed you are really is a setup for two classes of statistics. One thing that you can do, clearly, is just go and measure each of those endpoint correlation functions. So the 2-point is the power spectrum. The next one, which would be zero for a Gaussian, is the bispectrum. So this is a great place to look for non-Gaussianity, because you think it's the first place where you have a non-zero measurement if you're non-Gaussian. And it has a couple of features. One is that, again, there's this delta function. It doesn't matter, right, which way I rotate the triangle in the sky or where I put it, I should get the same answer because things should be isotropic and homogeneous. So there's a delta function which tells us that this is a triangle function momentum. So as Claudia mentioned, there's more information here. This is a more involved function than just the power spectrum. And you can keep going, of course. You can write down any endpoint function, and you get more and more information, more and more complicated shapes. But basically, we could also do anything else, right? That we don't have to just look at particular correlation functions. And one example is anything that sort of is sensitive on the area under a part of this curve. So one example that's interesting that people have been doing for a long time is to look at the probability of very large objects, for example, clusters. And what that says is to figure out how many very large objects there are, we need to figure out how many regions of space were so dense that those fluctuations collapsed into the structure. So you can roughly integrate the probability distribution above some threshold, you know, over which you say stuff is so dense that it collapsed into a gravitationally bound object. So this kind of statistic depends on the area out here, not just a particular 3-point function. And if you want to calculate something like this, as a theorist, you need to go back and provide that probability distribution, or as much of it as you can, in order to get an accurate result there. OK, and that's not the only thing you can do, of course. There are all kinds of things that are analogous. You can imagine, you know, essentially an infinite number of statistics that you can check, that you can measure. And for any of those statistics, then, you need to understand how to translate what you measured into the fundamental model. And since we're not sure what the fundamental model is, we need the largest variety of statistics we can in order to probe this. So many people take a translation that tells you, for example, the number of clusters in terms of something that's related to the amplitude of the bispectrum. Okay, so you want to understand how to do that comparison for a general model. Okay, so we need to go back and ask questions about the fundamental picture of inflation. So let me remind you what that is. So first of all, this is a basic point that you already know from field theory, right? When I'm talking about non-Gaussianity, things above the power spectrum, I'm talking about interactions. Interactions, of course, we love as physicists because that's how we actually probe the fundamental physics, right? We think the Higgs is there, but until we go and look at its interaction with other particles in a collider, we're not exactly sure what's going on. So just very sort of schematically, the quadratic part of the action, of course, gives you the propagator. And any interactions that you add, for example, a quartic interaction, are going to give you a 4-point function. So this is essentially the same idea in inflation. There are a few, you know, slight modifications, and one of those is that we're going to look at the statistics of fluctuations. Right here, I've written an action for phi for the scalar field, not for its fluctuations. And maybe the more important point is that slow roll usually implies that things are nearly Gaussian. So whenever you go to a CMB talk, you hear fluctuations are Gaussian to an incredible precision. And of course, that's true. And one of the reasons that people always say this is that this interaction is going to tilt the potential, right? So if I want a flat potential, which means I get enough inflation, this interaction can't be very large. Okay? So usually people say things are extremely Gaussian because of slow roll. Okay, let's be more specific. What do I mean by nearly Gaussian? So this is a particular ansatz, the local ansatz, which was written down a long time ago for cosmologists to use and has been used ever since. And it's pretty simple. It's basically, if you wanted to go and heuristically write down what does it mean to be non-Gaussian, you might do this. You would say that the real curvature field, curvature fluctuation, is mostly Gaussian. So let's start with the Gaussian piece. And let's add something that's just nonlinear in that Gaussian field. So FNL is this F nonlinear coefficient, which sort of tells you how non-Gaussian the thing is. And you correct it so that you get the right mean. So FNL is usually the parameter that people quote when they say how non-Gaussian something is. So let's ask how non-Gaussian, for example, is slow roll, do we expect? So I told you it was related to the flatness of the potential. So remember, the spectral index was measuring the slope of that potential. So you get this parameter, FNL, of order, the deviation from the scale of variance, which is a really small number. So FNL 10 to the minus 2. So that's much better than we can actually do with measurement. Even if you just say, well, gravity is a nonlinear process, right? And you evolve the fluctuations simply thanks to gravity, you end up with FNL of order 1. So that much larger than this number. And observationally, we haven't come anywhere close to that. So it depends slightly on which model you're looking at, what the limit is. But you can see that it's nowhere near this limit or this limit. So there's actually a lot of room to play. So this is still incredibly Gaussian, right? This number should be compared to the amplitude of fluctuations, which is 10 to the minus 5. So it's still incredibly Gaussian. But it's not necessarily slow roll Gaussian. And that means there's a lot of room to discover new physics in there. And importantly, the Planck satellite should go up. And if Planck is able to detect non-Gaussianity convincingly, it's going to detect it at a level of about 5. So that rules out all single field slow roll inflation, which is huge, right? Because most inflationary models are built on that idea. So there's a lot of potential here in the next few years. Yeah, very important. Yeah, thanks. That's important. Yeah, I should say. So here I'm really talking about what do I get from interactions of this very fundamental field. So once you evolve everything forward in time, you get all kinds of signals. And you can have this. It's still a border of
few. Gravitational lensing of CMB, I think, brings it up to 10.
Yeah. Actually, there was just a paper right a couple of days ago reanalyzing this.
Okay.
So yeah, so the more interesting question then in that context is, are we actually going to be able to subtract out all of these other effects that we don't think are primordial? And especially, you know, could we someday get down to this level? Because that would be a true test, and that's probably very difficult. Okay, so the bound is nowhere near this NS minus 1 number. That's what we expect from slow roll. Slow roll is important because that guarantees that we get enough inflation, so how large can non-Gaussianity possibly be in a reasonable model? So actually, several ways this can happen, and there are several that I'm not going to talk very much about. One important one is to have multiple fields, so not have only a single field. And I think Adrian talked about this a little bit, and Louis will talk about a particular model where that happens later on today. You can also temporarily violate those slow roll conditions, right? Slow roll has to hold. You have to get enough inflation, but that doesn't mean that at some particular point you couldn't have some feature. And if you have some bump in the potential, for example, you can generate sort of a localized non-Gaussianity. You can also change the initial conditions away from the bunch case vacuum. That gives you something else. But what I want to focus on, because we can sort of really beat the thing to death, is the single field case, where we can put in derivative self-interactions to get large non-Gaussianity. And why does that work? Well, if you imagine the flattest potential you could possibly have, that would be a case where you had a shift symmetry of the field, right? So phi goes to phi plus a constant doesn't change anything. If that's the case, the kind of interactions you can write down are derivative interactions. Those aren't effective. So what happens if we write derivative interactions? Those can be large without spoiling the flatness of the potential. The other interesting point where this originally occurred is that actually, in some cases, having those interactions changes the dynamics of the field in a way that means you don't actually have to have as flat of a potential as you thought you did. And that was the original one of the original features of this DBI inflation that made this whole idea popular originally. So that's what I want to talk about, those kind of interactions. What does that look like? So let me show you an action. I want to expand in derivative, particular type of derivative interactions. So this is P because it's the pressure. This is basically what's going to sit inside the integral reaction. So it's like the Lagrangian density. So this X is just a shorthand for the standard kinetic term. And in inflation, the background is homogeneous. Oops. Oh. That's a problem. Oh no, I'm sorry.
Is it charging now or not?
It's completely dead. Okay. I'm going to restart it and I'm going to keep talking, okay? So the homogeneous background, the spatial part of that cancels out. So that was a standard kinetic term, right? But you can basically think on the background as that just being phi dot squared, just really just the kinetic term. And so what I had there were powers of that kinetic term. And as I increase powers, dimensionally, I need to also add a mass scale. So there's some mass scale that comes in. So what I was showing you were basically phi dot squared over m to the 4 some power, okay, some mass scale. So that mass scale is going to be essentially the scale in physics. In generic case, I don't know what it is. We don't know what it is. Could be a string scale, the Planck scale, whatever. It's going to take a long time. But there we go. But that tells us something interesting. And if that scale is the Planck scale, those interactions can't possibly be important, basically, right? Because the potential energy is, this is Buffalo for you. Basically, the potential energy has to dominate, right? So if the kinetic energy is too large, then we don't have inflation. But there's no reason that scale has to be so large. So this is distracting, I know. But so basically, we say, well, most likely it's the Planck scale. But why do we say that? There could be all kinds of physics in between the Hubble scale and the Planck scale, right? There are orders of magnitude there. So it's not so unreasonable to think there could be some scale in your physics between H and M prime. And if that's true, then those derivative interactions can be important, especially if the potential is nearly flat. Okay. So maybe I can make one other point without you looking at equations, which is if I'm expanding in that quantity, which is phi dot squared over this mass scale M, right? So I think that quantity is small, so I can do an expansion. Then I can't ever get very large Non-Gauss quantity. This was nicely shown by Paolo Criminelli a few years ago. So I have to go in a regime where that M is actually small. Okay, there it is. Sorry. So, M is the scale of new physics, N is below M Planck, and these terms are important. If I'm doing this expansion, and I think I don't have to, I can throw away all those terms, X over M root 4 has to be small, and so FNL is about 1. There's an interesting example that sort of started this whole field off in some sense, which is the example of the DDI action. So this is a case where string theory, really symmetries, tell you that you have some reason for a particular object to sum the series of these powers of x over m to the 4 into a square root. So you have some reason to believe that you know this whole series. And if you know that whole series, the square root tells you that basically this number can approach 1, and you still know how to write down the action. In that case, it can be very large. So this is a surprise if I'm just starting with sort of an effective field theory point of view, right? I don't know what to sum those terms to. It's sum to anything, and I can't really control it. But here we have a symmetry argument, essentially, that tells you that you can do that sum. And if that's the case, you get some surprises. First, the non-Gaussianity can be very large. And in the particular scenario where this occurred, there was even another feature, which is that this mass scale was really the warped string scale. And so as inflation progressed, the non-Gaussianity ramped up. Okay, so it looked like there was essentially no limit to this number. It looked like it was getting enormous. So does that make any sense? Well, there are a lot of ways we can answer this question, and there are a lot of approaches to single field models. I'll just put some of them here in case you're familiar with them. I'm basically going to focus on the last idea, that we should write down the most general theory of a single field that we can, and we should make sure that it encompasses something like DDI if we can. So here's a generalization just writing that action that I already showed you in a slightly different form, where I just included the gravity term now, and again, here's what x is. And these sort of actions were used in a different context before, okay, inflation. And the important thing that happens with these models is that the horizon that scalar fluctuation c changes. So there's essentially one new parameter that comes in, the sound speed. And this is derivatives of that function with respect to that standard kinetic term. So in the usual case, this is just one. If I start adding more and more large, higher derivative terms, this becomes smaller and smaller. And that means that the horizon where scalar fluctuations freeze out shrinks. Okay, so it's a very physical, even though it looks complicated in the action, it just gives you this one new parameter which rescales the horizon. Okay, so how crazy can we go with this? What kind of terms can we add, and what, how large a von Gaussian can we get? So let me show you again this local ansatz, because it's easy to answer the question here about how large, how non Gaussian things can be. So in this case, remember, we just added this parameter times this piece that was quadratic in the Gaussian. So if I calculate the two-point function, for example, I expect my answer to be nearly Gaussian. Of course, you're going to get a correction, right, coming from this guy, squared. So that correction tells you that if you don't want that correction to be too large compared to the usual answer, this parameter f and l can't be too large compared to the amplitude of fluctuations. Okay? So built into this ansatz is a criteria of what it means to be too non-Gaussian. Okay, what happened with our model, for example, of brain inflation? It looked like the sound speed was going crazy. Sound speed gets smaller, f and l gets larger. So at some point, this should go out of control. And we can actually ask that question in terms of any of these models for a general field and come up with an interesting answer. Okay, so if we go back to this general case, which I showed you, how do we answer the question? Well, let's do the usual thing. We're going to expand the fluctuations because we want to look at correlations of the fluctuations. To first order, there's a simple relationship between the fluctuations of the field and the curvature fluctuations that we can use. And the two-point function, let me remind you, just has this amplitude that I'm calling p zeta. Okay. So we expand that action in fluctuations. We have the background piece, the first, you know, the piece that's linear in fields vanishes due to the equation of motion. We have the quadratic piece, and that's what we usually use, right, to quantize the fluctuations. And if we do that, we get an answer that the amplitude of fluctuations is h over m prime in the Sobral case, modified by this 2 epsilon cs factor. And we can check, for example, that the gradient energy in these fluctuations is small, so that we still have inflation. And then we want to check that the interactions are small, so that this whole thing is perturbative, right? So just in that, like in that field theory example, when you start expanding and finding the diagrams, you have some limit on how large those interactions can be. A similar thing is going on here in terms of the fluctuations. So we want to limit how large these terms can be. And if you do that in a very naive way, just by taking essentially the ratio of the first interaction term evaluated on this background, and requiring it to be small compared to the two-point function, you get some reasonable answers. Slow roll, you basically get that h over m Planck is less than 1. You find the interesting constraint that q zeta has to be, can't be too much larger than 1, although this is, the fact that it can be slightly larger than 1 is related to eternal inflation, but those look like reasonable conditions. In the sound speed case, you get something slightly more interesting. First of all, you get that this interaction bound is the more constraining of the two. And what that does is tell you that the sound speed can't be too small, right? It's just what you expected. If the sound speed was too small, interactions were too large, this thing was too non-Gaussian, and you lose your derivative control. So here, the amplitude of the fluctuation is the two-point bounds, how large the interactions can be before you can't control this series. Okay? You can derive this in a variety of ways, and all of them arrive at the same answer. So what that means, basically, is that something like that case where the sound speed is increasing, which is interesting phenomenologically, there's some point, if you put in the scale dependence of both of those things, there's some point where you don't trust that, the fact that it's growing linearly anymore, which affects models where you might be looking for signatures of non-Gaussianity on smaller scales. You don't expect to see anything larger than essentially that 10 to the 9 halves value, or else you haven't, you know, you can't control your original calculation of the fluctuations. Okay. So you can go beyond what I just showed you, and you can actually say, okay, let me look at the whole structure of correlation functions, because it's not just that first term that matters, right? We want as many statistics of this thing as we can get, and some of the statistics don't depend on just the endpoint function. They depend on some way of combining correlation functions into a probability distribution. So you can show that pretty generically, as long as there's no crazy fine-tuning of coefficients, you can write down the interaction terms as something that's proportional to that quadratic part, find something that goes like this ratio of the 2-point over the sound speed. Okay. So I'm just going to ask you to trust me on this, but I'm happy to discuss it in more detail if you want.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Here you are just assuming the DBI, or is it more?
This is the sound speed model usually. So this is the usual expansion in X.
Like, I mean, you don't have this any new scale like the usual.
No, what you do have is the ratio of coefficients of new terms in the action, right? So I'm assuming those coefficients are all order one. Right, like the lambda term,
yeah,
where you take some combination. So this basically says that the lambda over sigma is not too large. So you're assuming that you haven't fine-tuned, so you have a surprisingly large coefficient far down the action. So in a sense, you have this plus a string of conditions on the coefficients if you want, but they're sort of just natural conditions. And once you see this, it's really easy to estimate what the correlation function is. Basically, you know that the dominant contribution comes around the time of horizon crossing. And that means that you can do something very simple in the expression for the correlation function. And once you do that, you see that there's a nice behavior where this thing cancels out. And you can write down the structure of the endpoint functions for this model. So this scaling is actually a surprisingly common scaling that shows up in gravity, shows up in the local ansatz. And what it means is that if I take the dimensionless combination of these correlation functions, which is the thing I need to expand around the Gaussian, I basically get just, you know, some order one coefficient times this combination to some power. And that's that original condition that we needed to check that the 3-point function wasn't too large. So that's actually a generic condition to check that your interactions aren't too large. Okay. There's basically one condition on the sound speed in this model. And it comes, you can show that that says that you can control this whole series of correlations. It's a little bit surprising, right? Because this is a small number. CS can be a small number. So at first sight, when you look at these correlations, you say, well, I've divided by a small number, and as I go to higher and higher orders, I've divided by that number more and more times. So it looks like it's getting out of control. But as long as this condition is satisfied, you're actually fine. And you can do better than that. So that was for the small sound speed model. But you can say, well, why did I write down a small sound speed model? You know, I liked it. It was nice. But if I was really writing down the effective field theory for a scalar field, I wouldn't have just written down those particular terms. I would have written down every single possible term I could have written down. Right? And so if you write down every single possible term you could write down that's unique at each order and derivative, so you do integration by parts. And if you use the equation of motion, right, to remove things like box phi in terms of the potential, for example, you can get the most general action for a scalar field. And at four derivatives, Weinberg did this recently at four derivatives, and he essentially showed that the only new term is the term you expect for the sound speed case. It's an x squared term. That's it. The only thing you have. So in that case, all the work you did for those small sound speed models, for the, you know, the fluid models, carries over. At six derivatives, that's not quite true anymore. You certainly have the term that shows up in the P of x and phi models. But you also have another kind of goofy combination of a higher derivative term here that you can't eliminate. So you might ask, well, if once I start including terms like this at all orders, is my same perturbative condition still valid? And this is essentially, if you're familiar with this, a rewriting of something that these people did in a different notation, the fluctuation. So you can check. You can say, well, each of those terms that I added, this x squared term, this x cubed term, and this funny combination of derivatives, gives me some contribution to this interaction term. And you can estimate the size of that contribution because you know roughly the size, because the horizon size sets for you where fluctuations freeze out. And you find exactly what you expected for the terms coming from x was that it's just this ratio that comes in. And for the term coming from that new set of derivatives, you find what looks like a new ratio of parameters, h over n. Remember, n was the scale of new physics, basically, times the sound speed. Okay, it's not really a new condition, as it turns out, because you had the condition already that you were expanding in higher order derivatives. You had this perturbative condition. When you combine those things, you see that in fact guarantees that this condition is also satisfied. So it's sort of nice. If you are trying to do the most general theory of a scalar field, there's one perturbative condition, there's one variable you're expanding in, essentially, that controls the whole series of the most general action. So this is kind of nice because it's a little more physical writing of the condition in terms of the fundamental scales, but it's the same thing. And you can go back just for fun and say, okay, what happened to that brain action? If I use this DBI case, it looked like the sound speed was blowing up to infinity. So clearly that can't be right because there must be corrections that come in at some point. And you can ask what those corrections are. And people have written them down. So This is just a point saying that, actually the brain, the fluctuations are under control. They're not string scale size. If they're string scale size, the brain would be sort of self-annihilating. But you could ask, what have people written down for corrections to this action? And you see that basically the first term, what's up to some function in front, is exactly the term that we wanted, the term that we expected. We were writing down the most general theory of the scalar field. So of course there are corrections here. So essentially this, you know, just like you would expect, the corrections come in at the point where you don't trust the perturbation theory of the fluctuations. Yeah.
So the direction of DBR is based on this assumption of Lorentz invariance in the ball. And so then I assume the corrections would also couldn't be the most general correction. That would also
So this is a very important point, right? If I write down, so for example, what Chung and all did is to write down a completely general theory of fluctuations. But you can see here that what's happening is the same symmetries that tell you you're allowed to do this sum and get into the limit where FNL is large also dictate the form of these terms. So they're not independent, really. The same symmetries that allow you to do this allow you to do this. And so, for example, the feature that, you know, this whole thing vanishes when x vanishes, this whole thing vanishes when this goes to 1, those are features that are coming up because of the symmetry of the theory. So it's a little bit funny. I'm not sure what it means to say that we're taking the large FNL limit in a theory where we don't know what those symmetries are. Because then, you know, it's out of control almost by definition. But in a case where you do know, then you can write it down and you can check that this way. So, yeah, it's very interesting. Okay, so that was a lot of stuff and interrupted in the middle. So let me just remind you, the key point is that we really want to test inflation. And there are all kinds of new statistics that will be available in the near future to test inflation. And what those statistics are really measuring are fundamental interactions of the inflaton, you know, up to all sorts of issues about how those fluctuations evolve. So the most important thing for us to do as theorists is to figure out what can I possibly get by writing down fundamental inflation models, and am I sure that I can translate that model into any possible thing that cosmologists can measure, any possible statistic they can measure. So we need to look at how correlation functions behave, how they scale, and things like that. For a generic single field, you can get the complete answer for completely general action. And the two important points are that the level of non-Gaussianity, which is quantified by this thing called the sound speed, is perturbatively bounded. So if you think you're doing perturbation theory, if this gets below a certain number, non-Gaussianity gets too large, you have to stop and go back. And you can actually simply understand the entire structure of those correlation functions. And the structure is such that you're allowed, as you would expect, to sort of expand around the Gaussian distribution as long as you have this condition satisfied. So you can basically go forward with all of the nice things that you would like to go forward with, that you sort of expect you can go forward with from field theory, as long as you satisfy this condition. Okay, I'll have questions.
Questions? Comments?
Yeah, so the correction to the higher order correction to the DPI.
Yeah.
Is there some obvious way to see that it comes in as an overall? I mean, is it just the way you write it that it comes in as an overall multiple thing multiplying this verb? Or could there be?
Yeah, so that's an interesting point. I mean, one argument for why it always has to multiply the square root is that the thing for nine grade is determinant of G, right? Determinant of the metric. So you expect that to multiply everything. You know, you can also make arguments. Basically, I think how part of how this is derived is by expanding this thing and expanding this thing and actually calculating, you know, at each level what the next what interaction is generated in higher gradients. But it also is just kind of nice, right? Because, you know, these all have the feature that when the velocity is zero, of course they're zero because you want to recover the usual D-brain action. And that as this goes to zero, the whole thing collapses. So you might say this goes to zero once you hit the speed limit, which is again constant. So again, you might expect that the whole thing goes to zero. So I think it makes sense. And the reason it's sort of a guess is that you, in principle, know this whole function, but you can only sort of get terms in this by doing an expansion. So it's still a little bit of a guess. So you would think that supersymmetry, et cetera, fixes everything here. But when people actually go to try to check all the terms, it's a little tricky.
Why do the sound speed expect it to vary during the observable course of inflation?
Yeah, that's a great question, because the question is, can you measure it, right?
Right, and
yeah.
Can you measure the scale dependence?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I love to talk about this. the parameter that tells you how fast the sound speed is changing has to be sort of a slow roll parameter. If it's not a slow roll parameter, you have corrections even to the two-point function. So you expect that the variation is a slow roll parameter in the power. So just like, it's basically a spectral index, again. The thing is, that's actually observable because you have a range of observations from the CMB to something like cluster scales, where you can still calculate how big the effect should be. So if the running of that is, you know, the order 0.1 to 0.3 in that exponent, which is a small roll number, and if you did measurements of clusters or the galaxy bispectrum, compared that with CMB, so you have a long range over which you observe that, you might be able to observe that. And that would, just like the tilt of this, you know, the spectral index being slightly red tells us interesting information. I think that scale dependence would tell you very interesting information too.
The chances are you couldn't see it in the CMB alone. You would need CMB.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks. So, I think Cherry is too shy, but he has a paper that says the speed of sound can vary a lot and Hubble can vary a lot. Neither of them would be as plural in that sense, but the two of them can give you a scaling
variant. Actually, that's a great point, right? Because because what I didn't show very carefully was that the combination that comes in, is a combination
of that.
Exactly.
Well, go ahead, follow up.
I had a little question. So if C varies a lot and say that non-Gaussianities, let's say non-linear, developed but at extremely low scales, say very small galaxy scale. Would you be worried about this? Do you think this is pathological, or is this a regime that we don't serve directly
This was kind of part of the question originally, because when we looked at what happens with the scale dependence, it looks like it gets huge. You would think primordial black holes, you would think all kinds of things like that would be a problem. And I don't know, what the best test is at smaller scales. I mean, maybe you do 21 centimeter eventually, but it would be really nice if you could have some constraint at an even smaller scale before you hit this perturbative limit, because that's a big number.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, if you don't mind, ask one last question. So is this an extrinsic curvature?
This is the extrinsic curvature, and you can check that it's less than the string scale.
So that last term that you write, the first correction, that is that F MNL MKL, that's determined by the form of extrinsic curvature, or is it a free function?
This part?
Yeah.
So this part is just a function of X around the four, and in principle it's determined by supersymmetry. But then this part is, essentially going to be this magnitude.
Right. So that's a bit strange because so you think that Lorentz symmetry would fix that form because extrinsic curvature it has a particular form, right? So I don't know why.
This is it written in a simplified form calculated for the brain, and the magnitude is the same magnitude that shows up here. And I think sometimes people write the corrections for the brain actually.
So why should there be an explicit velocity dependence in there?
In here. So that's the surprise, right? It's if you just started writing down the most general theory, you wouldn't be able to write down powers of this that escape, right? Because you would remove them by brain's motion. But if you write down the most general thing, you think you need this around the form. And if you want to ask about corrections that you get from expanding this action and figuring out what higher order derivative term is generated, sort of that effective field thing means. Then you also get the fixed proportion for this to cancel terms.
Okay.
So I guess we should move on. Let's thank Sarah again.